Hello and welcome to Patron Deities, a show by deities for my patrons. I'm James Holloway and I'm reading my way through the Deities and Demigods supplement for Advanced Dungeons & Dragons 1st Edition. And as I do, I'm talking about the gods, heroes, and mythological beings that I find in it, and how to use them, and religion and mythology more generally, in your fantasy role-playing games. In today's episode, we are continuing our journey through the Indian Mythos chapter of Deities and Demigods. And we're going to look at three related deities, well, sometimes related and sometimes not deities, from that chapter. So let's get started. Our first deity is the sun god Surya. Surya is the sun god, like all deities we've discussed here. He also has a more spiritual interpretation, so he's like literally a god of the sun and a god of light, but therefore metaphorically he's also a god of enlightenment. And he is very frequently depicted with a chariot drawn by seven horses, often with Aruna as his charioteer, and sometimes with his brides or consorts, one on either side of him. We'll talk about one of them a little later on in this episode. Surya is one of those deities who is very important in the Vedic cosmology, and who then made the transition to Hinduism, and in a lot of the early history of Hinduism, he continued to be very important, but then his worship kind of, like, I don't want to say his worship declined, because he continued to be very important, but there are definitely, like, waves of foundings of temples to Surya. He kind of lost some of his prominence in contemporary Hinduism, even though he certainly does remain important. He's also more important in some regions than others, which is something that we have to remember, right? That Hinduism is not necessarily a uniform faith. There isn't anyone whose job it is to make sure that all Hindus are practicing the same rituals, and local and regional churches can be really important. Plus, of course, also turns up in Buddhism. Talk about that in a second. So Surya has many other names, like most Vedic deities do, and one of those is Savitar or Savitar. So if you're a fan of the TV show The Flash, or in fact, I think the comic, in the late 90s, early 2000s, I think, there's an idea that Savitar is like a god of speed. I don't know about that. Surya is sort of associated with light and energy, but I don't know about speed. Maybe there's some interpretation that I'm just not aware of, but even if that's not where the concept of the character Savitar comes from, it's certainly where the name comes from. And as I mentioned earlier, he's important in Buddhism, again, because of that. Well, I don't want to say in Buddhism. He is important to many Buddhists, because once again, the idea of a deity of light serves as a representation, not just of literal light, but of spiritual enlightenment. Light triumphing over darkness can be seen as good triumphing over evil, or knowledge triumphing over ignorance, as we saw when we discussed Diwali, the festival of light. The mechanics of Surya in this book are pretty much just sun god, which works okay because Surya's portfolio does include a lot of kind of characteristic sun god stuff. I'm particularly fond of the mechanic that says that Surya can sense things that are touched by sunlight, so he can see anywhere the sun shines. I think that's a really cool image. Surya's chariot is often depicted as having one wheel, and that wheel, or chakra, which is the word for a wheel, not chakra in the sense of like an energy point within your body, right? You may hear it described that way in certain spiritual traditions, but chakra just means wheel, and it can, you know, mean the wheel of the Dharma. The throne disc-shaped weapon is a chakram, but the single wheel of the chariot obviously represents the sun and also reincarnation and the cyclical nature of the cosmos. In some myths, Surya is said to have a son, and that son is Tvashtri, or Tvashtr. I don't know how to pronounce that. Presumably it's also pronounced Tvashtri, but it's sometimes you'll see it spelt without the I on the end. And obviously I do not know Sanskrit, so I can't tell you why that is the way it is. But he is the craftsman of the gods, the divine maker. And he fulfills the role kind of as you would expect, in that he's sort of the person who made the weapons or other artifacts that are associated with the gods. So for instance, he made Indra's thunderbolt. In Vedic literature, Tvashtri is sometimes actually kind of a rival of Indra because his acts of creation basically make him like this creator deity, and therefore kind of a rival for preeminence among the gods. Because he makes things also, he is sort of wealthy and resents, you know, when Indra takes his cows, or, you know, perhaps more understandably, when Indra kills his son. Back when we talked about Indra, I mentioned the story of the conflict between Indra and Vritra, the demonic personification of drought And in some versions of the story, the reason that Vritra is there to fight Indra is that he has been summoned as an act of vengeance by Tvastri. So Tvastri is upset with, you know, these many wrongs that Indra has done him, and therefore brings Vritra so that they can fight. I think it's interesting that Tvastri is a craftsman, but his portfolio is not technology per se, but the act of creation, divine creation. So he is said, for instance, to create people before they are born. So that the metaphor of being like a carver or a smith or whatever extends to the creation of non-mechanical or non-technological things, because it's not the things that are important, but the act of making. So the analogy of like making a weapon, making an iron axe, which is his characteristic weapon, extends to the act of making a person, even though we wouldn't necessarily put the creative act of having a child in the same category as the creative act of making a tool. And I think that that's a really important reminder that the categories that we impose on, well, I mean, on anything, but specifically on like the divine, are kind of arbitrary. And there's no reason that a culture or, you know, a faith should see its deities according to those other categories. I really like that aspect of Tvastri. In fact, you know, this is something that's been coming up a lot throughout this chapter and that I think is really important, which is that cultures often have multiple ways of seeing the same deity. And those ways of seeing the same deity are not considered to be in conflict with each other, but rather to complement each other. Tvastri is the patron of artisans and is prayed to by artisans, but he also embodies the idea of creation, the power of the act of making things generally. And that then gives you all kinds of like spiritual metaphorical explanations for who he is and what he does. And I think that this recurring theme, you know, whether you're playing a game that's based on a Vedic cosmology or not, that recurring theme is one that is a simple one to include. For instance, to give an example, you know, one of my players is thinking about playing a cleric in the next game. And that means, of course, the question arises, cleric of what? And the different deities, you know, the sort of core faith, although there are many other minority faiths, but the sort of most common faith of the part of the world that they're going to be in is based around these eight primal or elemental gods, the gods of day, night, life, death, air, earth, fire, and water. But those roles are then expanded. So, for example, the goddess of night is also a goddess of like mystical illumination, but she's also said to be a goddess of thieves. But she's a goddess of all the things that could be said to be dark or shady or shadowy, which can include things like dreams, you know, so she's said to like provide prophecies through dreams, but not just things that are literally night, but things that are metaphorically night. And there's also some overlap. So for example, both the deities of night and fire are said to be deities of love. And all of those faiths are understood by people in different ways. And those different ways are seen as being true, right? So the philosopher priests of the sun deity, the day deity, believe that their deity, you know, like the idea of sunlight, you know, shedding sunlight on something, of rational enlightenment as opposed to the mystical enlightenment of the night goddess. They believe that their interpretation of their deity as a force of truth and enlightenment and the virtue of honesty and sort of transparency, they believe that that's a higher interpretation than, you know, focusing your attention on the fact that, like, this is the god that makes the sun rise in the morning. But they still believe that their god makes the sun rise in the morning. They don't not hold that other interpretation. And it's just a good way to communicate cultural values. So if I put something surprising into the night goddess's portfolio, then you would go, huh, that's interesting. Why does this culture consider that to be a suitable subject for that goddess? Speaking of goddesses, and kind of speaking of goddesses of the night, we've got Ushas up next, the goddess of the dawn. Ushas is probably the most significant goddess in the Rig Veda. She's got about 40 hymns dedicated to her. Now, obviously, that is a lot fewer than big-name male deities like Agni or Indra, but it's still pretty significant. That's a good chunk. There's definitely deities that we have talked about that have fewer hymns dedicated to them. Like Surya, she's often depicted drawn in a chariot. Surya is sometimes her husband, but in some myths, he is her son, which I quite like. I like the idea, you know, son is the child of dawn. That's quite a good image. She has other relatives. We spoke about her sister, Rutri, the goddess of night. And so that idea that, you know, dawn and dusk are sisters, that's a fun one. But because she has some, you know, so many hymns, I thought I would quote one of them here. This is hymn 113. This is the Griffith translation, which is, you know, pretty outdated, but I guess that's why there's a bunch of free ebooks of it, huh? Okay, so this is, as I said, hymn 113. This light is come, amid all lights the fairest. Born is the brilliant, far-extending brightness. Night, sent away for Savitar's uprising, hath yielded up a birthplace for the morning. The fair, the bright, is come with her white offspring. To her the Dark One hath resigned her dwelling. Akin, immortal, following each other, changing their colors, both the heavens move onward. Common, unending is the sister's pathway. Taught by the gods, alternately they travel. Fair formed, of different hues, and yet one-minded, night and dawn clash not, neither do they travel. Bright leader of glad sounds, our eyes behold her, splendid in hue she hath unclosed the portals, she, stirring up the world, hath shown us riches, dawn hath awakened every living creature. Rich dawn, she sets afoot the coiled-up sleeper, one for enjoyment, one for wealth or worship, those who saw little, for extended vision. All living creatures hath the dawn awakened, one to high sway, one to exalted glory, one to pursue his gain, and one his labor. All to regard their different vocations, all moving creatures hath the dawn awakened. We see her there, the child of heaven apparent, the young maid flushing in her shining raiment. Thou sovereign lady of all earthly treasure, flush on us here auspicious dawn this morning. She, first of endless morns to come hereafter, follows the path of morns that have departed. Dawn at her rising urges forth the living. Him who is dead, she wakes not from his slumber. As thou, dawn, hast caused Agni to be kindled, and with the sun's eye hast revealed creation, and hast awakened men to offer worship, thou hast performed for gods a noble service. How long a time, and they shall be together. Dawns that have shone, and dawns to shine hereafter. She yearns for former dawns with eager longing, and goes forth gladly, shining with the others. Gone are the men who in the days before us looked on the rising of the earlier morning. We the living now behold her brightness, and they come nigh who shall hereafter see her. Foe chaser, born of law, the law's protectress, joy-giver, waker of all pleasant voices, auspicious, bringing food for God's enjoyment, shine on us here, most bright, O dawn, this morning. I mean, and it goes on and on, but I thought that that sacralization of time was really interesting. The idea that the dawn as this repeated phenomenon in the world, and thus this repeated divine phenomenon, links past and future generation, that we look upon this dawn and the similar dawns have been looked on by people who went before us and will be looked on by the people who came after us. And that little note of death in the middle of it, right? He who is dead, she wakes not from his slumber. But this idea of waking up everything, kind of, particularly if you think about it as a counterpart to that hymn to Rotri that we talked about last time, where it talks about how, you know, her coming sends everybody to bed. You know, now it's time for us all to go home and rest from our labors. And then the next one, I mean, this is not, I'm not saying this is the order they come in, but this one has that reversed image of, you know, dawn coming and everybody getting up and going to their job, each one to their particular whatever it is they're supposed to do, including enjoyment, right? It's actually one of the first ones. And interestingly, this one, this hymn, and I mean, this is not the only hymn that this idea appears in, there are actually a bunch of other ones, translates directly into one of her abilities in the Deities and Demigods book, which is that she has the ability to awaken all good aligned creatures around her, right? So, you know, if she feels like she is in danger and needs help, she can just wake people up to come to her. Now, I don't know about this. It's hard to imagine somewhere that the goddess of the dawn is where it isn't daytime, you know? It sort of doesn't feel like it makes sense. So maybe people are just napping, or maybe they've been put to sleep with a sleep spell, but I like the idea of her power being awakening. Not necessarily that I think it would have an immense amount of, like, practical use, but I do like the idea of all the creatures of a given alignment or all the devotees of a particular deity just suddenly sitting bolt upright in bed, right? That's a good thing. And kind of looking around to see that many of the people around are still asleep, but, like, at the monastery of the Dawn Goddess, they all just snap to. That'd be pretty cool. I think that, you know, when you're running a game, you need a little repertoire of something's up, a little collection of something's going wrong here, but I don't know what warning signs. And I think that that's a really good one because it uses a common experience waking up, and it doesn't have any, like, you know, you don't wake up to the sound of an alarm or that you had a terrible dream or anything like that. But nonetheless, you do wake up and think, well, it's weird not just that I, you know, snapped out of my bed at 1 a.m, but that loads of other people did at the same time. Clearly something is afoot here, and I don't know what. And I just think that, like, that makes a good addition to the collection of something's afoot, but I don't know what signifiers that I presume that you, as a game master, keep updating. I also like the association with prosperity, you know. I don't know whether that's just because, like, the light of the dawn is golden, or is it the idea that, like, daytime is when you work and work is where you earn money, you know, or is it just the idea that every new day is like a gift, it's like a treasure, right? And those are all good possible explanations. I feel like we are seeing more discussion of meaning from within the religious traditions that these deities are part of. I don't know why that is specifically, other than that, like, if you look at something like Norse mythology, there just isn't much in the way of, like, an exegetic literature about those deities. You know, insofar as that tradition is written down mainly by people who, like, don't share those views and are interested in those stories, not as sacred stories, but as fun stories. You know, are interested in them from a literary perspective more than from a spiritual one. Not that that's true of every pantheon that we've looked at, but it is interesting the extent to which the Hindu literature about these Vedic deities is very much kind of, you know, this is what they symbolize. And it's nice to have two layers, or more than two layers, to these deities. I think that's something that's very handy to have in, you know, if something exists in your game world, it's nice for people to have multiple kind of overlapping views about it. All right, that's about all the Vedic deities that we've got time for today. In our next episode, we're going to be taking a look at yet more Vedic and Hindu deities, so I hope that you will join me then for Patron Deities, a show about deities for my patrons. Thank you for listening, and thank you very much for supporting Monster Man on Patreon.